The Vox Markets Podcast. Nothing in this podcast is intended as investment advice, and the people in this podcast may hold positions in the stocks they talk about. Do not buy anything based solely on a tip or recommendation. Please do your own research.
Welcome back, everyone, to Vox Markets Live. My name is Paul Hill. I'm delighted again to be able to speak to equity analyst and stock market commentator Paul Scott to discuss all things small caps. So welcome, Paul.
Thanks, Paul. Hello, everyone.
Well, it's great to have you back from Gozo, Malta again. Certainly been an eventful week, actually, with the S&P 500 down now in correction territory from its all-time highs, more than sort of 10%, largely on the back of fears over what the Trump trade tariffs are going to do with global growth and business and consumers' confidence. But before we sort of getting through all that with what it means for stocks and so on, have you been doing anything at all with your portfolio over the last sort of like week or so?
Not really, no. I don't tend to, as you know, I don't really tend to react to these macro market gyrations because it's just the normal, it's how markets are. You know, they go up, they go down, 10% correction, perfectly normal the way I look at it. And people always apply, you know, make up a whole list of reasons for it. But the reality is, I think the US markets were probably overbought. And all we've done is give back the last 5 or 6 months worth of maybe a bit of an artificial rally. And I think it's actually healthy to get corrections in markets. They can't just go up in a straight line, can they? So no, I'm annoyed and I hate seeing my portfolio in the red, but it doesn't alter my view of the fundamentals of any of the companies I'm in. So how about you, Paul? Are you panicking and spitting out your Cheerios every morning over breakfast?
My cornflakes, yeah. No, I think you're absolutely spot. I mean, my portfolio is in the red as well. I'm sure everybody is who's listening to this, unless you're sort of like being pretty lucky. But I think you're absolutely right there with the what's happening in the market. It's just a valuation correction because this S&P 500 entered the year on about 22 times. And I think it's on about 20 times now. But what was quite interesting and telling, I thought, this week was that inflation over in the States did actually start to soften and came in slightly below expectations. And what that means is that actually, if the US and say Europe has got to grips with now this inflation, we're not going to get that second wave, then at some point in time, the central banks, particularly if we do start seeing slowing GDP growth, will push the interest rate button to reduce borrowing costs, and therefore you do have this sort of central bank put. So it is, I think you're right, it's just basically a reset on valuations, not something really something to worry about.
Yeah, and you've got to remember as well with the indices, particularly in the US, there are so many vast amounts of electronic trading going through with trading algorithms and things that the indices are really played around with a huge amount by vast, you know, multiple trillions of transactions, where people are not betting on that they think a company is fairly valued or underpriced. They're just chasing a short term, you know, maybe millisecond price movements. And so it's not, you know, it's not an accurate measure of what companies are worth. It's just a volatile exchange of short term trading in shares. And, you know, mind you, the Russell 2000 has dropped more than the big tech, because the big tech that stuff seemed to take the brunt of this, didn't it, in America? Well, I think that could be actually good for UK small and mid caps, because a few people, it wasn't that many, but a few people who I follow and who follow me were saying, I'm done with UK small caps. I've taken over two years of pain. I'm just going to buy Nvidia, Facebook, and whatever. And of course, that, as I said last week, I think is usually a good indication of a market top in terms of the things that they're looking to buy. And they've suddenly taken an absolute whack on those things. And meanwhile, all our boring old REITs giving 7-8% yields and at 30-40% discounts to NAV and attracting takeover bids are all of a sudden starting to look, UK value is starting to look a lot more attractive, funnily enough. So this could actually work out to our advantage, I think.
Yeah, I think you're absolutely right. We've got a question actually just relating to that. Abel Savini is basically asking about REITs and takeovers. And we had two actually this week. We've got Life Science REIT, which I think you own. I don't want to give an update.
Yes.
And we also have another healthcare one, Care REIT, which does, I think, residential healthcare, or should we say domiciliary care and stuff for elderly people. How do you actually see this REIT? Because it's a call of the year from you, this one. It's the one thing which is actually doing really well.
Yeah, it's the only thing that's done well. No, but it has. I mean, to me, it was just free money sitting on a plate. I know that sounds flippant because you can't say that they're all going to be amazingly good value. You do have to do the careful research. What's the loan to value? Is that low? What are the actual quality of the assets? The vacancy rate, you know, the terms of the bank debt, is the weighted average cost of the debt going to rise? Have they got maturities on the debt coming up? You know, you've got to dig into the detail. But it seems to me there's a clear pattern emerging of bids, takeover approaches coming through for the better quality assets, particularly the care, the health-related ones. We also had Assura, didn't we, that owns, I think, 600-odd GP sites, and these high quality healthcare assets are attracting bids very close to NAV, which reinforces the fact that these NAVs on these REITs, EPRA NAV as they're calculated on a standard formula, are actually pretty watertight. And then I got a bid on Warehouse REIT. So two of the five REITs I own personally have now received sort of not formal bids, but possible bid approaches, and they've gapped up. And there was another one today, I forget the name of it, that also does healthcare related, I think it's care homes as well, about 500 million. It reported H1 results today, and that has risen 10 or 15% in the last few weeks in sympathy with the others. So I think a lot of us now are scratching around looking for, well, where's the next one? Where's the next bid? Mm. Where are the only ones I'm not quite sure about is one of my holdings, CLS Holdings. Monster discount to NAV. It owns office blocks in the UK and Germany. Are we going to get bid approaches for the maybe more questionable assets? That's the thing I haven't seen so far. So, have you looked at REITs, Paul? I'm not sure if we've discussed this before.
Let me just put the chart on for CLS, which is, this is a big tester. Hopefully everybody can see that. So I'm praying because I've been told by a tech team, it's got the problem from last week is sorted. So you're right, absolutely. It's the shares have performed pretty poorly, haven't they?
They have. They haven't bounced at all, as you can see. And this one is majority owned, I think, by a family trust, who I'm told are completely passive. They're not. They don't take any role in the running of the company. And a lot of these REITs as well have very expensive arrangements with the managers, who really are on a big gravy train. And that's particularly obvious at the smaller ones, where the administrative costs of the managing agents are outrageously high in some of them. And so a lot of them are now negotiating, are doing buyout deals with the managers as well to reduce the admin cost, but with a cash up front thing. So it's a fascinating area, but I'm just saying to people, don't just buy any REIT that you see at a huge discount. You do need to do some basic research on it, but it's not rocket science. Any of us can do it if we put the time in.
Yeah, what's the NAV on the CLS compared to the 70p per share price?
I don't know off the top of my head, but I think it's at a more than 50% discount to NAV. They did have, it's a little bit more complicated because they did have a material uncertainty on the going concern. But I looked into that and I think it's a complete red herring. Basically, they've got some debt maturities coming up, but there's no reason at all to imagine that those would be a problem. And also the interesting thing with CLS is all the debt is siloed. So there are not group guarantees on any of the debt. So worst case scenario, they could just let one silo go. But as they've said themselves, they've never done that in the company's history, including in 2008. So, you know, the situation now is nowhere near as bad as 2008. So I think that is a complete red herring, but we'll see.
Yeah, we've got another one from Lemon Physical. He's suggesting people should, in the REITs area, have a look at SafeStore, which he says is basically now trading at 0.6 of net tangible book. So this is another one. And this, I think SafeStore, just from memory, I think basically does sort of temporary storage of people's in lockup garages.
John from Malta, who I'm seeing, one of my followers, and he's mainly on Twitter. I'm seeing him tonight, actually. We're having a quick drink and a catch up. He mentioned this one to me as well. So, yeah, there's so many. The whole REIT sector is completely, I don't know what the word is. It's just completely
mispriced.
Mispriced, yeah. It's because all these things were set up. The people who own the shares don't really want to hold the shares because they bought them when everyone thought interest rates would be zero forever. But private buyers are buying the actual properties at or near NAV. So it's just a complete structural mispricing that is giving you a fabulous opportunity to buy a pound for 75p, basically.
Yeah. Well, I've got another one, actually, because I've bought it this week, okay? But it's not a REIT. I class it as a shadow REIT. And it's in healthcare. And it's basically what... It's sort of turning that sort of scenario. So what I class as treasure is other people's trash. And the reason why I say it, because we discussed it last week, is Spire Healthcare.
Oh, yes, yes.
And why do I say it's a quasi-REIT, okay? Yeah. Okay, first of all, it owns 38 hospitals in the UK and a number of sort of primary care centres as well.
And owns and operates. It's not just the owner, yeah.
It doesn't just own them, it operates, yeah? And the reason why, the reason why I say it's a quasi-REIT, because if you look at, I think it's in the fixed assets note of their full year results. And there they put the market value of all of their freeholds, and they reckon it's worth 1.4 billion compared to a net book value for those freeholds of less than 700 million. Okay.
Yeah.
If you look at the net tangible book value of Spire Healthcare compared to its current share price, it comes out at about £2.50 to £2.60. Can you hear me now?
Yeah, it restarted, yeah.
Okay, sorry about that. We do seem to have a bit of a dodgy connection for some reason. I can hear a bit of that audio feedback. But anyway, if you look at the net tangible book of Spire Healthcare and you use the 1.4 billion instead of the 700 million, then you get basically £2.50 to £2.60 per share compared to a share price of 180p. So it's got huge tangible book value. Now, what is the usual sort of return you get from a REIT? You typically get a dividend yield, don't you? And a bit of capital upside. So you get about 7, 6, 7, depending on it, if it's infrastructure, 6, 7, maybe 8% if you're lucky. The actual return on capital employed at the moment for Spire is 8.2%. And that's going up into low double digits over the next 3 years to 11% and 12%. So if you like REITs in healthcare that are cheap and trading at less than net tangible book, then I suggest you have a look at Spire Healthcare. I have, and I just disclose, I've bought shares, so I now have a full position in Spire Healthcare from this week because I just think it's too damn cheap for a really high quality business that's got massive, massive barriers to entry. There's nobody who's going to be able to buy, build another hospital in the UK unless it's the NHS. My thesis, is that totally rubbish, Paul?
You're going to hate me for saying this, but I totally disagree with you on this one. I do take on board your point about the valuation cap on the freeholds. I've made a note while you were talking, actually. I've got to check out that fixed assets note because you mentioned that last week and I haven't, it slipped my mind. So I totally get that. That's a valid point. But my main problem with it is that after the depreciation charges and the interest charges, it hardly makes any money. It's only about 3% PBT margin. So it doesn't matter what the assets are worth, unless you're going to sell them and to somebody who's going to get a better return from them. So I think it's a low quality, low margin business personally.
So if you wanted to realize value, you sell the assets at net tangible book, you get 1.4 and you get £2.50. And then if the operating business is zero, which it won't be, basically that's all upside compared to £1.70, £1.80.
Yeah, okay. Oh, no, fair enough. I mean, I just think if it was going to be restructured, but I don't think there was anything. I mean, I went through the results as well. There wasn't any indication at all in the results that they're thinking of restructuring it and splitting it into two. You know, I just think the combination actually destroys value. And it's got a very checkered past. If you look pre-pandemic, this was not a good performing business. And we don't want to repeat everything we said last week.
Rather than viewing it through the lens of an operating business, view it through the lens of an asset. with an operating business and what somebody else could do. And that may change your view. But anyway, if it doesn't, it doesn't.
It could. But the thing is, Paul, the alternative investments is I can buy something like Labs, which is still at almost half NAV. Oh, actually, I've just destroyed my own argument because I was going to say it pays a 7% dividend yield, but it cancelled the yield today. That was a terrible example, but take some other REIT that hasn't suspended its divvies. And, you know, you get a nice 7% yield and you get the discount to NAV, whereas with Spire, you only get the discount to NAV and you get, I don't think it pays divvies, does it? Or not very much.
Spire, it pay 1%, less than 1%.
Yeah. So I can't see why you go for that as opposed to something else that's also at a similar discount that's giving you a 6 or 7% yield. That's all I'm saying, Paul.
Yeah. No. I get it. That's all right. It's fine. Okay, let's move to some fallen angels in the consumer sector. Let's look at 4imprint, and we mentioned that the US is getting a bit sort of like wobbly because of Trump's trade tariffs and what that means for the business confidence. These 4imprint basically do promotional items and memorabilia that people that sells it to corporates that they can pass on to their particular customers. Shares have really come off hard. Now, is this a fallen angel or is it a value trap?
I think it's a fallen angel, definitely. I don't own it myself, but I did have this on my top 20 share ideas for this year. So that obviously knocked my averages a bit when it warned on profit. It was a very mild profit warning, you know. Now, they look at my notes here on the 21st of January. It's almost entirely a US business, as you alluded to. So 4imprint did an ahead of expectations update on the 21st of January this year. So that was good. And then it, where was it? Yes, this week, I think, it was yesterday or the day before, I think, 12th of March, it dropped 17% to £39.55 on a slightly ahead update for its 2024 actual results. But it said in the outlook statements, the year-to-date current year orders are, quote, slightly down. And it also announced a special divvy. And Cavendish lowered the EPS estimate for 2025 by only 6%. So the way I look at this is a very minor adjustment, which is consistent with the US macro position having gone a little wobbly in the last month or two. I don't think the business is in any way broken. I think it's just following the macro trends, and I think it's a buying opportunity. So I did buy some at just below 40 quid for my friend's ISA, which I manage for them. So I think it's good. Yeah, I think it's more a buying opportunity than a structural problem. The issue would be if it now comes out with another profit warning, you know, and the forecasts to drop by a bigger amount than just 6%, which is neither here nor there. So as things stand at the moment, I think it's a high quality business in sort of mid-season sale.
I can't add into that, Paul. I think you're spot on there. It looks to me like a class act that has delivered years and years, and just going through a softer period, basically, and a bit of uncertainty, but should be, as you rightly say, they may actually beat expectations later in the year anyway.
I think they might do. And the other thing at the moment, in this kind of market we've got at the moment, all sorts of companies are coming out with mild profit warnings. I think there's a lot to be said for keeping a bit of cash back in reserve, have your watch list of all the companies you've researched and that you like, and then just wait for them to do a 20 or 15% drop on a profit warning. That's your buying opportunity, isn't it?
Yeah.
Providing it's something, you know, temporary and fixable, not that, you know, the whole business model's unraveling. Yeah. That's the thing, isn't it?
So on that logic, what do you reckon about sausage roll maker, Greggs, which is basically, you know, that the sort of delicatessen stroke retail performer in the UK that shares have really hit a bit of a the break, to say the least, and largely on the lack of slowing growth.
Slowing growth.
I think they trade now, though. I've got about 13 and a half times PE, and they've got a pretty strong balance sheet. They've got cash on the balance sheet.
Yeah, the balance sheet's okay. It's not, it's okay. I wouldn't say it's particularly strong. The rot really set in, didn't it? Like you say, in the last 3 months. I think the market's really overreacted here to what were only very mild disappointments in terms of like-for-like sales. But the only sort of tepid outlook statements, the profits are still rising. So I think my take on it is that I've turned green on it because I think it's dropped too much. But I would add that, caveat that by saying that I think it started off at the sort of in the middle of your graph at the top there. Mm-hmm. It was significantly overvalued, I think it's fair to say. So I think it's now come down from too high to maybe even slightly too low. So yeah, this is certainly on my watch list for potential buys. I think we called the bottom in our commentary. Obviously, we don't know what the shares will do. That's subject to all sorts of forces. But we felt when it hit around 18 quid, that's the level where we moved up from, I think, amber or amber green to green, because we think the value is now there. But you've also got market saturation, haven't you? With something like over 2,000 sites, there's not really much further they can go in terms of, they are still opening net new stores, but it's only sort of 5% or less store numbers per annum. And, you know, if you already have two in Bournemouth, for example, as I think they do, does adding a third one cannibalise some of the sales? I don't know. What do you think, Paul?
I think they just need to actually sort out the line queuing problem, actually, in the peak times.
Yeah, you're right.
They could get like for likes moving. It's really actually what's really interesting is this whole sort of theme on what the consumer will do, because as you rightly point out, we're still having a situation where there's real positive income growth compared to inflation, but lots and lots of consumer stocks are actually selling off. And we've got a question from Ben Sharman. He's asking about Churchill China, and you get the gist from the chart because it's another ski slope.
Incredible this one. Yeah, I should add, I've just bought some of these. We got them at £5.08, which I thought was a really good price, just a small amount for my friend's ISA. Quality business. I think it might even be now trading below net tangible asset value. It owns the freehold of its Potteries site. Bulletproof balance sheet, as I say. Inline update, I think it was in January, saying it's going to make 8.5 million PBT. It supplies a very heavy duty earthenware with nice designs. Is that the right word? Earthenware? Well, crockery, anyway. That's, to the hospitality sector. So it's different from Port Merion, which is more, you know,
dinner service.
Decorative, and dinner services and things. This is for the hospitality sector. I can't see any reason at all for the price having come down from, what was it, sort of, it wasn't long ago, actually, Paul. I think it was post-pandemic. This was 20 quid a share. It's now 5 quid a share. It's overshot on the downside, I think. So, and with the recent good trading update, I think it's a very, very good value, this one.
Yeah. What's the chance of them getting taken over? Because obviously it's a unique brand, isn't it, I guess? But
good question. Actually, its main competitor, I think, is Steelite, isn't it?
Right.
Which was bought out by private equity, I think, a few years ago. So I think there might be quite significant insider holdings, though, at Churchill China. I'm just, while we're talking, I tell you what, I'll come up with a shareholder list while we're talking. Maybe we can...
Yeah. Okay. All right. Let's move stay in the same sector in consumer, but this is more logistics side. Paul the Parrot is asking about Kitwave. That I think you did a big write up of it today. It's basically a distributor of impulse sort of ice creams and consumer items into convenience stores and the food service industry on a buy and build strategy.
That's right. Yeah, I like this one. I did a relatively brief notes on it in today's Substack report. Readers were nagging me to look at it, and I actually did, but forgot to type it up. So that's in my report today in the premium section. My conclusion basically is I think I can't see any particular reason for the recent fall in price. I think it's a similar chart to so many other small caps, isn't it? Somebody starts selling, other people think, oh, they must know something, and they start panicking and selling. But the recent results were fine. It was October 2024 results. My only reservation with it is the debt is now a little bit on the warm side. They've done quite a few acquisitions. I think it's slightly negative net tangible asset value now. Not an alarming problem with the debt, but just, you know, and it's just a bit too warm. And of course, debt's not cheap anymore, is it? Now interest rates have normalized. Not the most exciting business, really, a wholesale distribution business, but I think it was owner managed. I think, didn't the founder retire recently at Kitwave?
Yes, that's right. Yeah, yeah.
Mm. I think the
guy was called Paul Young. If I remember from the singer.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. That's right. And the PE now is down to, I think, about 7.5, 7.8. You've got about a 5% yield, but I think they're paying out too much. I think they're trying to please all people by doing big divvies and doing acquisitions. So I think they should. Personally, I would prefer it to scale the divvies back. If you want to be a buy and build type or a consolidator in a sector, I don't think you can really combine that with being a generous dividend payer, particularly where your debt is going up and up and up. So that's the question mark I'd have over it. But at £2.50, I think the valuation's come back down to a nice attractive level. So yeah, I like it. Yeah, you're.
Yeah. Yeah, no, I'm with you. I think it's a good, solid business. It's sort of less than 8x PE, nearly 5% dividend yield. Debt to EBITDA still is about 1x, so it looks perfectly manageable to me.
But I think it might be higher than that now, Paul, after the most recent acquisition. Are you sure it's only 1x?
I've got 1x, yeah, but I could be wrong. Yeah,
I just put a question mark on that. I haven't got the figures to hand, but it could be
right.
I don't know.
Okay, we got a question from Rebecca. I think is Aston Girl. She says greetings, Paul from sunny Lanzarote. So she's having a holiday as well. She's asking your thoughts on apparently there's an attempted acquisition by Greencore for Bakkavor, which I've missed to a certain extent, cash and share bid. Have you got any thoughts on that one at all?
No, well, that's news to me. Do we know, was that announced? Reece Bakkavor is the ready meals company, isn't it?
Yeah.
I'm probably one of their customers, best customers.
Yeah.
Oh, yeah, it's done a vertical rise. Here we are, Bakkavor rejects Greencore's second attempt. Cash and share. No, I hadn't spotted that. I'm sorry about that. I think that might have been in the last... Yeah, that's God. Rebecca's got her finger on the pulse. That announcement came out less than half an hour ago.
Cool, have you written your report yet, Paul?
yeah, missed the cutoff. But Rebecca's obviously sitting by the pool with her, I don't know, 50 Shades of Grey novel and her iPad streaming live news to her simultaneously.
I mean, I would say, you know, it seems to make perfect sense, which is what the share price is saying, because Greencore are famous for making sandwiches and Bakkavor is famous for sort of like, you know, prepared meals. You'd basically take the two factories, two businesses, and then push it through the same distribution through the supermarket. So I just think there's going to be huge cost synergies. And you wouldn't need, and also on the sales side, you wouldn't need more than one sales guy to sell both product ranges.
Greencore, is that the Irish? That's based in Dublin, isn't it? I think.
Is. Yeah, but they do. It's basically all the really nice sandwiches. They don't just do sandwiches; they do lots of prepared meals as well, largely for lunch times.
Right. Yes, I'm looking at my notes here. Bakkavor, my colleague Dave reviewed it on the 16th of January. It put out a trading update. This is Bakkavor, not Greencore, and it rose 6% on a trading update in 16th of January. So it seems to be trading okay. We can't get above amber on Bakkavor though, so it wasn't a share that we particularly liked, but not that really means anything. I think it's got a fair bit of debt, hasn't it, Bakkavor?
I don't know. All I would say is that it's going to have a look at the two shareholder registers, see whether there's any commonality between it. If they're doing a stock and a share deal, then if they've got common shareholders, it's going ahead because that's what the share price says to me.
Yeah, good idea. And I mean, they're not subscale. I mean, Bakkavor is 875 million market cap. So with the bid premium, which is about 20%, that's going to be a billion market cap company. So, they don't need to consolidate, do they?
No, you're right. Yeah. Okay. Thanks, Rebecca. That was a great one. Now let's move sectors. Let's go to construction and building. We've got Tom Hildrick. He's asking about Vanel, which came out with results, week, or a trading update. These guys are the UK's biggest piling and groundworks provider in the UK. They've also got a business out in the States. Their main sort of drivers in the markets are the house builders and particularly build to rent big sort of apartment blocks, but also they've got a heavy exposure into rail with network with HS2. And I think they're also moving into energy, which is energy transition and stuff like that. So they've got a nice little spread, but they did say this week that I think some of the property side of it, the blocks of flats were getting delayed by the building saving regulator. Anyway, how do you see it? Cheap stock.
Well, we liked it. In January, we covered it, 29th of January, Van Gaal put out its interim results, which were not great, down 20% earnings. And it did talk about challenging market conditions and expected delayed projects to start accelerating because of the planning system blocked. So it sounded quite perky on the 29th of January. But as you correctly say, we had a more negative update this week, 13th of January, which was basically a profit warning, widespread project delays. But it's only slightly below management expectations for April 25 year end. It's reviewing its operations in Canada, strategic reviews. It sounds like it might dispose of those. And then Dowgate put out a note on that, which you can see in on Research Tree. What we like about it, we've stayed positive on Van Gaal despite this drop because it's so well asset-backed. It doesn't have any debt. It's trading well below net tangible asset value as well. And it's obviously a cyclical business. And, you know, these delays should sort themselves out as macro conditions hopefully at some point improve. I mean, God, this has been going on for about 5 years now, hasn't it? What with COVID and supply chain, inflation, it's never ending. People are asking me, well, what is normal? We don't know. Anyway, we think it's just the valuation's too cheap now. I think if people are prepared to be patient.
Mm. Yeah, I think one thing, if you're going into the sector, just be aware that when they rent or effectively provide the services, they don't just obviously rent the equipment. They rent the operator as well. So when they have to actually... And so what the only outcome of that, it means that they've got greater operating leverage than a typical sort of like, you know, plant equipment renter. So once it goes quiet, they've got to employ the staff because they're not going to lay them off because they need them going forward. And they've got the higher equipment, the utilization rate waiting around. So when it goes well, they do really well. When it goes badly, they've still got, rather than just having the equipment sitting around, they have the employees sitting around as well. So it's a real high B to play on the upside, and it's early cycle because when your piling does happen, then these guys should do well. So just be prepared of that sort of volatility. Okay,
I would just add to that. I remember years ago, a broker talked me through the similar sort of thing with the electrical contractor, T. Clark. And he said, you know, they've got to retain that skills base during downturns in the employees. Yeah. So this, I think, could be very interesting if you're prepared to take a medium term, not even a particularly long term view. Say, I think Van Gaal, I might pick up a few of those. Might just dip the toe. I've got no money. I'm on margin call all the bloody time. The HMS Paulie Pilot is listing to starboard.
Never mind. In the same vein, we've got a question from Richard. He's asking about Watkin Jones, which basically does purpose-built student accommodation and build to rent. And this is very topical because if Van Gaal is saying, if they're correct, that and I think actually Barclay Holmes also said it this today, they're seeing delays in approvals of blocks of flats for build to rent because of the building safety regulator. They haven't got enough people, but maybe also because they're putting this building safety levy into the system. It's going to be announced. So anyway, Richard's asking about Watkin Jones, and it'll also, this building safety regulator will apply to purpose-built student accommodation and to build and rent. So wrapping all that in, what do you think about Watkin Jones trading at a significant discount to net tangible book?
Yeah, I bought a few just after the after it started doing that big rise. I say big, it's only pence really, isn't it, from 20p to about 33p. I caught about half of that move in a trade, but then I sold them. I just banked my profit a similar price to now. So that's the history of it for me personally. But it's it was much, much better, the figures, than and the standout feature about this was the balance sheet is still pretty strong, actually. Whereas when it was doing that precipitous fall in the second half of last year, I think management really communicated incredibly badly. They seemed to be telling the market, we're in a financial crisis, we're going to have to raise equity. And that's what everybody quite reasonably thought was that was the message that seemed to be hinted at. But they then recently, when it started to that vertical rise up, they basically said, oh, no, no, we were never going to raise equity. You think, well, why didn't you bloody tell the market? Yeah, crazy. So I think they've been a bit lax, rather, with the communications. But it's had this nice rebound, but it doesn't seem to want to go up any more. So that was the reason I thought, OK, well, that re-rating's run out of steam. The trouble is with this business, it forward sells large projects, and it's got a huge pipeline, but it only has to complete 5 or 6, something like that, big projects each year. And if it does that, it can make, in the good years, 50, 60 million profits. But the trouble is, you only get one or two delays to those projects, and it doesn't make anything. This is the trouble. And it had many years of delivering on time and on budget, but it's tougher now. Interest rates are permanently higher. So I think it's just an incredibly difficult business to forecast. And for that reason, I know why Richard and others like it, and I can see the bull case as well. But for me, I just thought, oh, I've caught a nice bounce. I'll move on now and just watch and see what happens. Is it one that you cover, Paul?
I spoke to Richard Crowe about it, actually, on Monday, Cotney Rebel, and this was one of his top two stocks for 2025 on a recovery year. But I would reiterate what you've said. Just be careful about this building safety regulator and the building safety levy coming out, because it might change the landscape. You would hope not, because the government want to actually build 1.5 million new homes. And if it basically turns off a lot of the builders into these sort of like high density housing sort of construction projects, then it ain't gonna work. So
you can't mess with safety, can you? So I think, and I don't know that it would definitely. I mean, the other thing is, actually, that reminds me of Watkin Jones. It's already made a substantial provision for remediation costs. So people say, oh, you know, they've taken the charge and da 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 da, which is true, but it seems to go up every set of results. They need an additional charge. Yeah. But the trouble is that creditor on the balance sheet will transfer into cash outflows. So just because you've made a provision and it's on the balance sheet, the cash hasn't actually gone out yet. That's the thing I think some people are missing on this. But it looks like I would treat that almost like a pension deficit. It looks like a creditor that's going to unwind in cash outflow terms gradually over a number of years. Yeah. And the business does have quite a big cash pile. And management, I think, came over very well on the recent webinar, Watkin Jones, where they're basically saying they're innovating in terms of how they are funding new projects, you know, looking for the client to basically come up with more of the, so it doesn't have to fund the work in progress and things. So I think it's potentially good, yeah. Richard could well be onto something, and he's very good at spotting these turnarounds. Very, very good. He gets a lot more right than wrong, that's for sure.
Yeah, no, you're right. Got a reply from Rebecca Aston Girl. She's saying that she needs to discuss her reading habits with you, Paul, because she's probably going to slap your legs, I think.
Yes, she'll give me a slap. That I know her fairly well, so she knows I'm only pulling her leg, I'm sure.
Okay, now we've got a really good question or observation coming from Mungo Blakely. It's basically what our thoughts or your thoughts on Grainger, which is the UK's biggest private sector residential landlord. Net tangible assets, EPRA basis, I think he says it's £3. Compared to the shares currently at £2. And he's also saying they're about to transition into a REIT this year, and they've got a solid BTR, build to rent order book. What's your thoughts on this one? Because I think Mungo's spot on here. It's looking ridiculously cheap for a very solid or quasi, you know, REIT with a good dividend yield on it.
Yeah, I mean, looking at that, to be honest, I'm not up to speed on this, so I can only talk generally about it. Looking at the headline numbers, price to tangible book 0.78. Well, that's similar to the REITs, isn't it? I don't see that's a standout feature, particularly.
Yeah, what you're looking at is not the EPRA one, because you have to look at the EPRA because they've got this legacy house ownership.
Oh, I see. The EPRA NAV is higher than it is.
Yes, EPRA's about £3, whereas the net, if you look at it, net tangible assets, it's about £2.50 or £2.40 or something.
Oh, well, that sounds interesting. Yeah, nice spot by the sounds of it. Yeah, we'll have to have a look at that.
I would say Mungo on it. Just think about the building safety regulator, because it may one add extra cost to its building going forward. And if it does that, then I know it's got relatively not stretched, but it's got 1.5 billion of net debt. So it may need to raise more money. Not that it's had any problem in the past to do so. And the other thing I would say is that we have recently seen a slowdown in rent increases across the market. They haven't. They're still at about 4% like for likes. But I think that the industry is seeing now 1% like for likes. That has softened up. And I remember listening to an interview from the CEO, Helen Gordon. She said, our business operates on like for likes of 3% or plus. So if it gets below that or goes negative, then just model that. But I do think you've just highlighted a really good thing that people might well want to have a look at, actually.
Yes, I think that does sound interesting. I like situations like that where there's a kind of angle on it, you know. And you might also want to ask Mungo what he's done with Mary and Midge. Sorry, couldn't resist that.
That was terrible, terrible joke. Okay, let's move just a bit of an update. Beaks Financial, the exchange software cloud provider for high frequency traders, the shares have been all over the shop this week on rubbish speculation. But anyway, what's your sort of latest view? Just explain what's happened, what the speculation is, and what you think about it.
Right. Well, the short version is an online publication came out and said that, didn't even mention Beaks, but said that NASDAQ has run into some regulatory problem where it's had to stop offering a high-speed connectivity service, which apparently was giving an unfair advantage to high-frequency traders. People joined up, took two and two and made five and assumed it was Beaks. Well, I've done some digging on this, and you never reveal your source, obviously, but I can tell you categorically it's not Beaks. So this is a complete red herring. And the shares have, as you say, been all over the place. I think they were £2.82 when this started. They dropped as low as about £2.40 maybe. So this is quite a sharp sell-off. People just panicked. And you know, if you think that a major contract's about to unravel, it's not necessarily daft to panic, because you can always buy back and you've maybe avoided a calamitous drop and maybe you have to pay about the same, 10% more to buy back in. So I wouldn't necessarily criticize the people who did panic. But anyway, strangely enough, the market is so logically it should be settling back at about £2.80, but it's dropped again today. It is now £2.54. There's no news from the company. I am speaking to them on Monday. Monday is results. And Beaks has been a bit leaky in the past. You often see a sudden spike down before results, all spike up the day before significant news comes out, which is a bit, you know, is not right. They need to be a little bit more careful, I think, find out who is leaking information and trading on it. But anyway, we'll find out on Monday what the position is. But assuming that there's nothing gone wrong, and I'm pretty certain this NASDAQ thing is nothing to do with Beaks whatsoever, but we don't know how the business is performing until we see the figures on Monday. So we'll give it. But, you know, assuming there's nothing bad in the results, then I'm currently green on this. I hold personally. I like the story. I like the business model. Pretty unique. Compound annual growth rate at Beaks is incredible. But we'll have to see what the figures are like on Monday. So I think you like it as well, Paul, don't you?
A great company. All I would say is it isn't, because I know the article came out with from somebody else, but I think it was mainly, you know, sort of like pushed around by the FT. And knowing the FT,
yeah, they followed up on it. Yeah, you're right.
Knowing the FT, they don't usually just sort of like, you know, shoot from the hip. They actually do check their sources. So I think it is. It's going to be interesting on Monday, because they're not the kind of publication who just fire willy-nilly on just.
Well, I don't think the FT actually directly mentioned Beaks, did they? Well, I could be wrong.
No. They talked about sort of the high frequency. So
yeah, if it is, I don't think they linked it to Beaks. That was the, as far as I'm aware. I don't know.
No, but I mean, if it is high frequency trading that they are stepping back on, if the FT are right, then that puts a question mark over the whole of high frequency trading, i.e. go forward growth. So all I would say is that
about that, because I think it was the issue was that there was a special super fast fiber optic link that apparently then allegedly that NASDAQ was selling access to for $10,000 a month. Mm. Well, that's not the Beak service, because the Beak service is a lot less than that and is still being offered for sale in the open market. So there's no, it's not linked to Beaks at all, is my understanding.
No, I don't think it is. I agree. I don't think it is linked to Beaks. Anyway, let's see what they say. There's no, I think that's the key. It just seemed a bit weird that the FT. Now, another one which has gone a bit, as like the shares are all over, lots of shares are all over the place, is Interseed. Is Interseed. I know we've talked about this one, but it seems to be largely based on what Doge is doing and whether it's going to, they're going to impact. This is Elon Musk reducing public sector and defense spending. And obviously, Interseed a part of a solution that channel partners sell into the US government. And I guess the concern is if Elon Musk and his troops start battering the channel partners across all of their contracts, then will there be a deferral of some of the software revenue, even though it's very small, that's sold via the channel partners into the government? Anyway, that's the fear, I think. And what's your thought?
Well, I'm not having a very good time with my software companies last year. Interseed and Beaks were both standout outperformers for me, but I've given back a fair bit of it this year to date. I think similarly, actually, with to Beaks, I think the Interseed thing is a complete red herring. And I messaged the company a few weeks ago and said, look, you know, the shares are just in free fall. We need, because people think, oh, you know, the whole Trump thing is going to mean that a tiny UK company in Lutterworth will be somehow frozen out of these things. Well, anyway, I didn't get a reply from the company because, you know, they can't. But they put an RNS out this week, which I thought was very reassuring. Mm-hmm. They basically said in there, look, we're continuing to win contracts, including some small federal, which is extremely important to them. The US federal departments is the bulk of Interseed's business. They've continued to win a few small follow-on orders from them. So there's not a sort of spending freeze on at all. And interestingly enough, they also said, just at the end of it, they just sort of quietly said, look, this is mission critical, what we do for the feds. You know, it's not something you can just rip out or switch off. This is mission critical, niche software within much bigger packages of security, cyber security software that is just vital to the functioning of those departments. So I think in this particular case, I think, again, this to me looks like a red herring. The trading updates have been good. They raised expectations back in January, I think Interseed did. So I bought some from my friend's ISA actually on about £1.36. So and I've still got my own positions in this in Interseed and Beaks. So I think these will blow over and turn out to be good buying opportunities. I know you were a lot more bearish on Interseed last time we spoke.
No, I like it. I'm not bearish on it at all. All I would say is that I think 50% of their revenue is recurring. It's support and maintenance and upgrades onto software. 50% is perpetual license, or about 30%. And I think there's some other services they do. But what that means is they've still got quite a big portion of perpetual license sales.
Yes.
I think what the market, the investors are fearing is not that it's basically mission critical, that everybody knows it is. And it's not that there's any question mark of how good the software, because it's first class, it's top of the tree on it. I think what the market is doing is that because it's chunky contracts, perpetual, if they get caught up in deferred orders of part of much bigger scoped contracts sold by channel partners and software integrators, then it might delay some of those, the recognition of those perpetual licenses over a period end. And I think that's where people are concerned. But frankly, if you've got a 3 to 5 year view, that it'll all wash over.
I think that's a possibility. Yes. I mean, I did wonder if winning new federal contracts might be harder now. I think that's a distinct possibility. But remember also that they have, I think it's at least one, it's very substantial annually recurring contract. And a few years ago, there was a profit warning. It was about $4 million a year. And they couldn't quite get it renewed by the year end, but it renewed about a week later. And what they basically say to you is these contracts run and run and run. You know, you're looking 10 years minimum for a Fed type contract. Some of them have been running 20 years. Also, the geodiversity was something they're keen to mention. If you look at the last update, they did say, look, we're actually now starting to win business in Asia. Now, that's quite interesting. And as you say, they're selling through channel partners now, which are large US consultancies like Guidehouse. So, you know, the feds wouldn't look at this and say it's a UK company. They would say it's a big American company. We're buying American. I'm bullish on Intercede. And also, market cap's now well under 100 million. It's got 16 million net cash. Yeah. So you've got balance sheet support as well. No dilution issues. Yeah, I like it.
Yeah. I mean, the technology software is my game. I mean, that's my bread and butter. And frankly, you always have a 50% drawdown in these stocks. I mean, I've had so many of 50% and then held and they've gone up like two or three times. So this is just basically, you know, what happens in life when you
take. Yeah, well, I admire your stoicism and your philosophical outlook, but you are right. If you've done your research and it's a good company, it's not broken, it's just market noise, you stick with it, don't you?
Yeah. Now, one of my companies that you asked me on the podcast yesterday on yours, I did listen to it because I'm a subscriber.
Essensys.
Yeah. Now, just to give people a bit of background, this is a SaaS software provider for large scale. Large scale flexible offices. Big exposure out into the States. About 60% of its revenues into the large big landlords, likes of CBRE, Blackstone. All these kind of guys. They also do in the UK and into Asia. They've been through trials and tribulations. Anyway, they came out with their interims this week. I was slightly, I've been a long-term investor and I've got a full position in these. I was slightly underwhelmed, to be honest. And the reason why I say that was because not that they met the sales targets, they met the cash targets, it's all good and well. And the EBITDA is going to be slightly softer in the current year because they've got extra costs of holding. They're shedding costs, but they're going to have to hold those costs longer to get rid of it. But that's not a problem. It's where you enter the 2026 year, starting, I think it's April or May or something of 2025. And the broker, Singers, has taken the sales down from 20 million in this current year to 17 million. And that's what underwhelmed me, because this is a high margin, 80% percent plus SaaS recurring revenue model. And therefore it lives and dies by organic growth. And they've just changed the CEO. Well, they're about to. The COO is stepping up to the CEO. And if he can re-energize that growth and get that going, and he's lowballed the 17 million for obvious reasons, because he's new into it, then it will do very well. And on that basis, I rate them as 2x sales, which gets you about 50 to 55p per share. Singers are on 60p compared to a share price of 35. But frankly, I was surprised it didn't sell off more, given they've taken down the sales forecast for next year, because I'd have expected them. I don't think there's a problem now in the cash, because they're basically going to be cash generative from Q4. So that's great. They're profitable as well. It just all comes down to growth, and they've just released a couple of new products. One of their intelligence engine, which is fab, and then this new bit of access software as well to run these massive buildings on a flexible office basis, which again is absolutely fab. But having fab products doesn't mean somebody's going to buy it. So you've got to sell these things.
Yes,
and that's really what it comes down to. The only way I've read this that the shares didn't sell off on the news was because I have heard on the grapevine institutions are trying to get stock on this, and they're trying, if anything loose pops out, they'll buy. So there's a few fund managers who are interested in picking up. Anyway, I don't know what your initial thoughts on this one, Paul.
Yeah, well, I saw when it announced results on the 13th of March, I thought, oh, that's that one Paul was on about. And I did do a little bit of research on it, and it's only 24 million market cap. Mm. And I thought, yeah, there is something interesting going on here potentially. So I'll look at it before 8 a.m. to see if I need to dive in and pick up a little scrap myself. But very much like you. And I would say, by the way, big respect to you for openly saying that, you know, you're a bit underwhelmed by the figures. Because normally, not you, but, you know, the tendency yeah. for us all is to talk up our own holdings. So I love it when people actually say, nah, it wasn't that great, and they're an owner of it. So respect for that. So, yeah, a little bit underwhelming, I thought. It was in line with the H1 results. Founder retiring, founder CEO, I thought I was quite surprised at. And it's a bit too keen about mentioning EBITDA all the time, but it doesn't translate into traditional profits. And I thought the cash was, I'm a little bit more nervous on that. It's only down to 2.2 million, which is getting a little bit tight, I think. Does it have a facility as well, do you know? I think it might.
Yeah, it's actually provided by the CEO.
Do you know why? Why he's, it seems a strange point when the company seems to be close to this inflection, a strange point for him to bow out.
Yeah, I don't know. I haven't got a clue. I would just say he's probably been asked by institutions to step aside and become a non-exec and let somebody... Okay. He's the founder and run it for years. Or he maybe yeah. just he wants to just give somebody else a chance because he's tired of the city, which is understandable. But
Mark Furness, isn't it? Yeah. And he's got 30%. So he could have told them where to shove it, couldn't he? So he presumably probably wants to take a step back, I would imagine. And COOs are often ambitious and want to prove themselves. So maybe it's not a bad thing.
Yeah. And as I say, if I'm right, which I've heard of the grapevine, there are institutions that wants to buy it, then they're probably calling the shots on marginal money supporting the business going forward. If they want to do M&A or they want to do anything.
Oh, that's a good point. Yeah, if they do want to top up placing or something. Yeah, interesting. Yeah.
Another one we talked about last week, which is definitely worth mentioning, is Traxys, okay?
And the reason why I
wanted to just mention it, I don't suggest we go through the investment case again, but I would. But I've heard on the grapevine, yeah, there's a number of fund managers now wanting these shares as well in this software. They want to accumulate for this long-term business opportunity. And what was quite interesting, it popped up on the Monday after we had chatted about it, but has stayed up there and stayed firm. And that isn't retail because everything else is going down.
Yes, exactly. Well, you see, this is the power of our podcast, you see. We can move the institutions following us avidly. And I don't think I've got anything to add, really. As I say, my friend's ISA, I got some at £3.08, which was terrific, wasn't it? I mean, it was only a little scrap because it's not a huge fund, but that's our top winner now. We're about 20% up in a week.
Well done.
We're not selling. I mean, we take the view. I think last week I said, I think there's line of sight to this getting to £6. You're even more bullish, aren't you? You're thinking £9, but over a number of years, neither of us is really trading this. I mean, look, so far so good. Let's see what the numbers are like, though, because I think we also agreed there is a possibility of an H2 profit warning, but it's in the price.
Mm-hmm. I can't because I've actually bought a full position. But if I hadn't bought a position, if they come out with a profit warning, which I'm actually anticipating they will, okay, a small one, but I think they'll miss it. I think that's when the fund managers are going to dive in. Anybody stupid enough to sell and miss this is going to basically buy that like anything. And I would do if I hadn't only had half a position. I'll take it as an opportunity. But anyway, let's see what they say.
It's a very good quality business. We've followed this one for years. Mm. And John MacArthur was an exceptional CEO. He built this from nothing, basically, buy and build, using, it's like a mini Judges Scientific in a way, in that he used the cash flows from the business that were required to fund, you know, deferred fund. It's a quality operation, I think. I don't think the business is going wrong. I think we're patient with this. It's really oversold. I think it lost, like you say, I think you picked up on the fact that there was just somebody in the market just dumping the stock, a distressed seller. And it looks like you took them out, Paul.
Yeah, there was that. And then before that, you had basically somebody just dripping stock in about hundreds and hundreds of single share sales to try and push it down. So a deliberate manipulation. But anyway, let's move on from that. We've got a question from Innes Gray, which I understand is one of your subscribers here, Paul. He's asking about Bloomsbury, the book publisher.
Oh, yes.
The shares have come down a bit, but it's a quality act. And I think one of their sort of rock star publisher authors, is it somebody Mass, Sarah J. Mass is releasing a new book next year as well. So the share, this could be an opportunity to pick up some stock. I think they trade at around about 13, 14 times PE.
I haven't spotted actually that they dropped quite sharply, haven't they, recently? Mm. But what hasn't? I mean, loads of things. One of the ones I spotted that I like, though I don't hold it personally, that's dropped sharply for no particular reasons in a similar chart is Phonics, FNX.
Yes.
So I think, going back to my point earlier, I think you have this watch list of companies you research inside out that you know are good. And if they suddenly drop 20%, you know, you nip in and buy some. I think Bloomsbury could well be one of those, actually. Looking at the numbers here, it's just dropped from £6.50 to £5.78 recently. It did spend the cash pile, I think, didn't it? Or a lot of it on a big academic acquisition.
Yes.
The only thing I'm a little bit perturbed about with Bloomsbury Publishing, which you've already alluded to, actually, is that a lot of the growth has been on these standout performing authors. You know, I don't think it's quite as broad based across the whole of the business. And then if there's a, you know, if there's a gap in the publishing schedule, you know, that can cause problems. But the valuation is looking very attractive again, I have to say. 13.9 times forward PE. Long serving founder management as well, I believe, at Bloomsbury Publishing. And they do have a knack of spotting these authors early, don't they? And then milking them for many, many years. So, yeah, I think it's looking interesting. Maybe a buy the dip one. What do you think, Paul?
Yeah, I think it's a good class act. Again, another really high quality share, which I may buy. I've actually owned it before and made some good money out of it. Unfortunately, I sold it too early. But I like it. Okay, we've got a question from, who was it? Basically asking about One Savings Bank. OSB. Rob is asking about some interims. I think they are just basically a build to let type mortgage provider and a bank, a sort of challenger bank.
A buy to let, not build to let.
Yeah, sorry, buy to let. Yes, that's it. Yeah.
Yes, it is. I really like this one. I have actually briefly owned this one myself. I thought it had fallen, but actually it's risen, hasn't it? Mm. It's very good, I think, OSB. I wish I hadn't sold them now, looking at that chart.
Sorry, I think, Rob, you've made a bit of a hole. You haven't made Paul's day there.
No, well, never mind. I mean, it's still at a discount to tangible book. It's at 0.7 times tangible book, very low PE. It did have some issues, as you can see from that vertical drop on the chart. That was a profit warning, but it's never been in any sort of trouble. It's just a night. What I like about OSB, when I've looked at it previously, I haven't actually looked at the latest news, but what I've liked about it previously is just so simple. It's a straightforward buy-to-let mortgages company where you get negligible defaults because, you know, buy-to-let landlords don't tend to default on the mortgages. And even if they do, it's secured on the properties. So the only real downside risk is fraudulent, you know, mortgages. But you've got a very nice dividend yield, currently 7.7%. You've got the discount to net tangible asset value. Nice, simple, straightforward, big balance sheet. So they just collect in deposits from retail investors, retail customers. Yeah. And it's just a savings, simple savings and loan bank. You've got very little black box or whatever you want to call it on the balance sheet, which puts me off conventional banks. You know, you don't know what the hell's in those gigantic derivatives figures on the balance sheet. OSB is much, much simpler. So it's easy to understand. I think it's quite low risk and I think it's good. Yeah, definitely.
Yeah. Another one in that sector that came out with results today in the subprime sector is Vanquis Banking. And the reason why I mentioned it is because I know it's a favourite for Richard Staveley, you know, the rock star fund manager from Rockwood Strategic. It basically makes net interest margins of about 18% on credit cards, equity release, and short loans, and it also has an agreement with H&T, I think, the pawn broker. So it serves the underbanked, I think, but it is a bank that serves the underbanked. So it must be subprime. But the shares are still trading at a huge discount to net tangible assets. Any thoughts about this at all?
Yeah, this is on my avoid list. It's just been too problematic in the past, so I don't even bother reading the RNSs from it.
Right. Okay.
Yeah, it's not for me. But you know, have you looked at it, Paul?
Yeah, the financials. If you ever looked on the metrics, Paul, you would just say, yeah, it's a no-brainer. But I'll just put the share price up. But looking at the shares itself, then you say, well, okay, there's a lot of risk associated. If we go through a hard recession, these guys are really going to get hit hard because they serve that really sort of like low income demographic or no income demographic. But
yeah, and I think a lot of it was, I think this fell apart because of regulatory attacks, didn't it? I mean, looking at the shares, 10 years ago, they were £26. Now they're 50p.
Yeah.
I think you've got to be quite careful with these type of things. So it's not for me, but good luck to people who've researched it.
Okay, we've got one question. We've got time for one more final audience question. Letizia09 is asking about B&M, the discount retailer for all things sort of like, Tupperware and all kinds of knicks and knacks and stuff like that. What's your latest view on this one?
It's back now. Yeah, I really like it. And it just keeps going down, doesn't it? Yeah, I mean, you've got the PE and the dividend yield now the same. About 7.5. It's not got the greatest balance sheet. It does have a little bit of debt and then negative net tangible asset value. I think this is another one where the most recent updates have not been sparkling. It has slightly disappointed, but I think the shares have really overshot on the downside now. And I think a lot of people are saying, you know, quite silly negative things about it. Whereas if you actually look at the long-term track record, you know, it's grown revenue and profits tremendously. And profits are largely holding up. They've dipped a bit. I mean, if you look at the broker forecast, yes, they've come down a bit. You're only talking about 10%. Mm. It's not, I think, again, the market, it's like with JD Sports, which I hold personally. The market seems to, and Greg's, the market seems to take a bit of bad news and just extrapolate it out into being some sort of catastrophe when it's not. So I think this is fundamentally a very good business and it makes good profit margins still. So slight disappointments on trading, huge drop in share price. That to me looks like a buying opportunity.
How much of the products they sell are discretionary, would you say? As in like, people, I know they're cheap, but if you go to a supermarket, you're still going to buy your milk, cheese, bread and kebabs. But when it comes to sort of B&M,
I don't know on that. That's an interesting question. I mean, the shops are gigantic. They're absolutely huge. And they just stock a completely eclectic mix of all sorts, basically, that they can get deals on and buy cheap. Mm. So the product range, you know, is very extensive, but it flexes and changes. So it's deal driven. Yeah. I mean, I don't know, actually, how much. I think it's the sort of place you get into the habit of going there maybe as a family or as a couple or whatever at the weekends and kind of almost like a not a day out, but do you know what I mean? Probably discretionary. You probably cherry pick the bargains, you know, and maybe it's almost like a jaunt out, isn't it? And grab a few bits and pieces, bit of retail therapy. Maybe people are doing Temu hauls instead.
Yes.
Or as well as, I don't know.
Yeah, no, I would say, you know, the attraction of B&M and quite a few of these type of retailers is that you go there to see what you can find, and it's almost like a treasure hunt. You go in there, you don't know what you're going to come out with, but you come out with a shed load, and it's dead cheap, and you're really impressed. But how long, whether that can withstand the likes of Shein and Temu being the assault, I don't know. But
I think they're very different products with Temu. I mean, for my sins, do an occasional Temu haul, and it is it is therapy. You know, it is excitement because it keeps giving you, you've got order another £5 and you'll get 30 quid off. And you think, what? And you go into a sort of frenzy. Before you know it, you bought all this stuff for about 300 quid's worth and it costs you 22 quid.
Yeah.
So I don't think any physical retailer can give quite that same buzz. But if you look at the actual products in B&M, a lot of them are quite bulky items, you know, food and drink, and not things that can really be air freighted. So I suspect it's probably not much of a, doesn't have much of a threat at all from Temu, I would imagine. But it's guesswork, isn't it? We don't know. Temu are actually apparently, and I think maybe Shein, are actually thinking of doing, you know, actually setting up warehouses in the UK and selling direct to consumers. Now that is the big threat. That could be a really serious threat, couldn't it?
Yeah. Okay, we've got actually just a final one. We've got Aim to Win. He's asking about what percentage is a full position in your portfolio. Mine's about 5%. It's about, that's what's your, what's a full position for you in your portfolio typically?
Thank you so much, Paul. It can be anything really.
Okay. And we just got, we got a quickie from Plain Smooth. He's asking about Plexus. I know there's no news. I'm just guessing.
Yeah, I mean, I'm miffed. Nearly said something else then, because they just leave these huge long gaps, you know, where you're just total silence from the company. It's not good enough. You know, a listed company needs to keep the part owners of the business informed. So I'm very unhappy with the lack of news. And obviously with no news, the share price just goes down. So I haven't spoken to them in months. I've got it on my to-do list to speak to the CEO, but I just haven't got around to it. And obviously I'm not happy with what the shares have done. I've lost a ton of money on it, but you know, the fundamental, I mean, the problem is they had those huge contract wins in 2022 and 23, and there's not been follow-up on it. That was always the risk, and that was a risk I took. So, you know, but I mean, I wouldn't dismiss it. I think it's got fantastic, proven, and valuable technology. So I'm in for the duration on this one, and we'll just see what happens. And I accept the risk, and maybe we'll get the reward. I don't know. We'll see.
Yeah. No, Plain Smooth echoes your sentiment. He's tried to contact them, sent them emails, no response. So, okay. Well, thanks everyone for your questions, but absolutely fascinating session again. Thanks, Paul, for all your insights. I just like to let people know we're going to do this on Thursday next week, on the Friday. So 3 o'clock Thursday, I'm going to, I'm heading to the beaches. We're not talking tropical beaches. We're talking Normandy beaches. I'm going for a therapeutic session to see what, you know, all about the Second World War.
Having interesting. Yes.
It should be some, I'll report back from there in a couple of weeks. But anyway, so it's next Thursday at 3 o'clock. But thanks again, Paul.
All the best. Always interesting. Always good fun. Thank you.
The Vox Markets Podcast. Nothing in this podcast is intended as investment advice, and the people in this podcast may hold positions in the stocks they talk about. Do not buy anything based solely on a tip or recommendation. Please do your own research.